Welcome to the Cop Doc Podcast. This podcast explores police leadership issues and innovative ideas. The Cop Doc shares thoughts and ideas as he talks with leaders in policing, communities, academia, and other government agencies. And now, please join Dr. Steve Morreale and industry thought leaders as they share their insights and experience on the Cop Doc Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is Steve Morreale, and you're listening to the Cop Doc Podcast. I'm coming to you from Boston, and I have the honor of talking to Dr. Joanne Murphy, who is right now in Belfast, Northern Ireland. I want to welcome you this morning, Joanne, and I'd like you to introduce yourself to the audience.
Hi, Steve. Fantastic to be here. It's lovely to talk to you, and I have the privilege of speaking to you in the afternoon. I'm very conscious that it's really early in the morning where you are, so well done with that. As you said, my name's Joanne Murphy. I'm a reader in leadership and organizational change in the Queen's University Belfast, and I'm the co-director of our new Centre for Leadership, Ethics and Organisation. And I suppose one of the reasons why we're talking today is that I've done a great deal of work and continue to do work regarding organisational change and leadership within policing in Ireland and further afield.
Well, thank you. I think it's ironic that in our world today, you reached out to me when I had put out a little teaser that I was starting the Cop Doc podcast, and you were one of the first out-of-country responses, and then I jumped on the phone with you shortly thereafter. And I appreciate what we've been able to do. You've pushed me towards members of the Police Service of Northern Ireland, and I'll be talking with one of those high rankers there pretty soon. But let's talk about how you got involved in policing, and you've written books. And tell me about what your trajectory, what brought you to the police world?
Yeah, so because I sit in a management school and a business school, people are always a bit sort of, oh, you do policing. You know, it's not that common. Although it's not invisible either. So I got into this area of work principally because I had an interest actually in conflict. And for anyone who knows about Northern Ireland, you know that policing and security is a hugely significant and has always been a hugely significant part of the conflict in these islands, in Ireland, and in the conflict that we've lived through. So as someone who was interested in conflict, I worked for a while in the community and voluntary sector in Northern Ireland. And in that, I began to see how significant institutional and organizational change was for organizations seeking to adapt to hopefully what was becoming at that point. And this was in the 1990s as we came towards the Good Friday or Belfast Agreement that happened in 1998. But organizations that were beginning to move towards what was hopefully a more peaceful time. And I was really privileged at that point to work with organizations like the Orange Order and the Apprentice Boys and the Gaelic Athletic Association. And also in quite a tangential way that what was then the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the police within Northern Ireland. Now, at the same time, I began to be very interested in organisational change and leadership. And I'd already done a primary degree in political science. I had a master's as well. But I was really interested in looking in more depth at processes of organisational change, and particularly processes of change that were closely connected to wider political processes. And I was incredibly fortunate in that I was sitting in an environment where I had the perfect case study, and the perfect case study was the organizational change process that saw the Royal Ulster Constabulary become the PSNI. And as we know, that was an incredibly difficult and incredibly emotional and also an incredibly telling and arduous process structurally. And so for me, that was a wonderful PhD to do. I was very fortunate to do my PhD in the School of Business in Trinity College Dublin, which if you know Trinity College, you'll know is just a wonderful, privileged place to be. And so that's how I got into this. I have written quite a bit since. As you said, I did a book on policing change, which takes an organizational perspective, because I think that a lot of policing work is for very, very good reasons coming from a more criminological orientation. But I firmly believe that in order to build peace and in order to move organizations into a better place, you have to look at the organizational end as well. That's absolutely critical. And I think we see that particularly in policing in Northern Ireland.
Well, having talked about something similar with someone from the RCMP, it seems to me that police are trained to deal with insurrection, crime, with keeping the peace in neighborhoods, and they are certainly not always adept at making broad change in the organization. And very often, I think they need outsiders to help to guide them. And it sounds like that was one of the places you were looking at, which I find interesting. Just before we came on, I was saying that you use the term peace, and you also use in both in Ireland and UK, you use the term human rights an awful lot. We don't in the United States. We use constitutional rights. And when you say peace and you talk about peace in the United States in policing, until January 6th, when our Capitol was attacked, that I don't think we thought that one of our jobs was in essence trying to keep the peace and trying to keep disparate factions apart so that they would not converge and cause chaos and damage and death. And so I'd like you to, you were watching from Northern Ireland, seeing what you saw. It must have made you scratch your head saying, this is the United States. That's a capital. Because it's certainly the way I thought.
Yeah.
So what did that conjure in your mind? Were there some similarity?
Well, you know, I was watching it with my husband and my 15-year-old son, who is really interested in American politics. And actually, it was the person that drew it to our attention because he was following the political situation very closely. And, you know, I mean, like a lot of people, it was like watching a movie. It was an extraordinary thing to see. It was something that I don't think any of us thought we would see in our lifetime, and not something that we expected to see within a country which with such a long, strong tradition of democratic ideals like America. It was the kind of thing you see where the deep structures of democracy just aren't as developed in other parts of the world. Now, I have to say, coming from Northern Ireland and having lived through the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the scenes were eerily reminiscent of some of the things that we have seen here before, and extraordinarily worrying. And that presents enormous challenges for policing and security, and of course politics. So it was, I mean, it was an extraordinary event. I think you have to really feel for the police officers caught up in it. You know, some of the footage which has seen since is terrifying, and clearly some of those individuals showed immense bravery, but also extraordinarily adaptive leadership in being able to read a situation and move very quickly to protect others who were potentially at risk. So, I mean, you will know better than me that it was something that none of us ever expected to see, but does raise enormous issues about the fragility of democracy and the significance of policing as a force for good as well.
Thank you, because that perspective is really important and not something we hear an awful lot about, because you're looking at it from the outside with some admiration at times and thinking, my goodness, if it happens there, what's going on? What's going on in our world? It's what I began to think of for sure. So as we talk about the transition, the transformation of the RUC into the PSNI, watching it from the inside, but watching as it happened, it must have taken some time. There must have been some resistance that had to be overcome, even within the organization, for that change. What is it that you saw? How did it take shape? What were the things that the leaders had to do to try to move from the old guard to a new guard with resistance from both the outside and the inside?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. I think we speak about a process of change like that, we are talking about something with enormous external environmental impact. And so I suppose the first thing to say is that it's really important that we don't underestimate just how difficult that process of change was for the organization to even contemplate, never mind undertake. What I always say to people in relation to the RUC to PSNI process was to draw their attention to something that happened a number of years before, and that was the fundamental review that the RUC did themselves in 1996. So there was quite a bit of internal thinking and planning and consideration given to what was happening externally in terms of security environment. There's no doubt about that. Now, it is also true to say that the fundamental review didn't deal with the really difficult, hard issues of symbolism, of name, composition. Those were not there. And I think while the organization itself certainly was able to contemplate some actually of the human rights focused work that needed done, I don't think that without external intervention, they would have been able to contemplate or to follow through on the name change, the symbolic changes, some of the compositional changes that were there. I think that that was where external validation and external impetus became very important. Now, again, it's very important to understand exactly what you're talking about. An organization with almost 300 people killed, 300 officers killed, many of those officers with the name of the organization on their headstone at their grave, you know, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the name and the crest on their headstone, contemplate taking that name away. away. Incredibly difficult. Now, of course, there was lots of choreography and lots of political gymnastics in terms of incorporating the RUC into the new title deeds of the organization. And we can talk further about that if necessary. But that is a difficult thing to do. In terms of the leadership of the organization, I mean, I say this very interesting in Northern Ireland, because everything in Northern Ireland obviously is politically skewed. And very often, you know, one side of the House in Northern Ireland have criticized my work for being too hard on the police in Northern Ireland, and the other side criticize it for not being hard enough. Because I tend to say that the leadership of the organization at that time were extraordinary in relation to what they were able to do. So if you look at the chief constables of that time, if you look at the leadership of people like Sir Ronnie Flanagan, people like Hugh Orde, those were leaders who really understood the task ahead and had both the authenticity and the authority to drive through what was an extraordinary process change. Now, I don't think that the process is necessarily yet completed, even though we're a long way down the road. Yeah, so I think that the organization were incredibly fortunate at the time when they had leaders who were able to articulate a vision for change, but also had the authority and the authenticity to drive through that change in an environment where there was undoubtedly very considerable resistance for very particular reasons, political resistance externally, but also resistance from those internally who, you know, when I speak to people, they speak about how hurt they were at the process, how they felt that that change was undermining the contribution of those who had served loyally and with credit within the RUC itself. Now, I entirely understand all of those arguments. I think you have to put them beside the arguments for those who were campaigning for reform. And you have to look at some of the material that we knew then and know since in relation to things like collusion with loyalist paramilitaries and some really, really bad behaviours. So this is a huge picture that we need to look at, but undoubtedly a very significant achievement to move the organisation as far as they were able to, and one in which leadership was absolutely critical.
Well, I want to talk about leadership in some depth, but it strikes me when you talk about the composition of the new PSNI, what does that mean?
So it's very important to understand that at the beginning of the change process, the PSNI, the RUC, as it was then, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, was almost entirely Protestant in its makeup. So Northern Ireland is a divided society. There are two main communities, the Catholic community, which is generally regarded as nationalist, Protestant community, which is generally regarded as unionist. And there's been a long history since and before the partition of Ireland in 1920 of antagonism and outright violence between those communities. Now, this is a very long running conflict we're talking about here, and that is a very, very brief summation of it. But it is important to understand that at the time of the change, I think the level of Catholic representation was 8 or 9%. I'd need to check that, but it was something along those lines. And therefore, the organization was by far the majority Protestant. Now, that created all sorts of issues in terms of representation and whether communities felt that they were being treated fairly and equitably by the police themselves. Now, again, other commentators would say, well, you know, Catholics, if they joined the police, were particular targets of Republican paramilitaries, Provisional IRA. Absolutely true. You know, so again, it's a complicated picture. But one of the most significant things that happened during the change process was what was known as voluntary severance. So officers, when they had reached a certain level of service, they were able to retire. I have to say, retire on what were at the time extremely generous conditions. Voluntary severance within the RUC cost in total £1 billion, that billion with a B. So now, this was before, I also have to say, the financial crisis. So there was a lot more cash around than there may have been a few years later, which is an important point to make. But money at that point was not an issue. So that allowed officers who took the voluntary severance route to leave, and many people have spoken and used these terms, to leave with dignity. And that was very important. And there's actually a lesson in that in terms of organizational change. People really don't want to be part of a new organization. They don't want to embrace a new culture. They don't want to do things differently. You're better to create a route to allow them to go. And I think the case study of the PSNI illustrates that better than most.
That's great. There are a couple of things that are so much different between Northern Ireland, Ireland, UK, and the United States. And one of the things that I observed when I was in Ireland and working with the Garda was the intense political oversight and independent oversight, which is similar to what goes on in Northern Ireland. We don't necessarily have that. And of course, you have a singular organization for the country, you know, one policing organization, as opposed to 17,000 police organizations, yes, in the United States. Our standards are skewed all over the place. But nonetheless, it sounds to me like what you were saying is that there was a struggle in some camps camps about police legitimacy. Do we believe that PSNI or RUC is our police when they're not like us? It's almost a question of diversity that
it absolutely is. Yeah, no, and you're absolutely right.
United States. So one of the things I was reading most recently is that while there was an attempt to gather or to recruit more Catholic, that they have not necessarily met their goals. Can you talk about that? Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly increasingly the case, you know, so Catholic recruitment was very successful at the beginning. I should say that with the PSNI moved post-voluntary severance to a process of 50-50 recruitment, which meant 50% Catholic and 50% other. Now, it didn't necessarily mean 50% Protestant, it meant 50% other. So that was a real bone of contention within the Protestant and Unionist community for a long time, and 50-50 recruitment is no longer in operation. There have been calls, and I think what you're alluding to are calls to bring it back. And the reason why there are calls to bring it back is that Catholic recruitment is dropping. And again, there are, I think, there's quite a bit of debate about why that is. I think there is certainly, of course, significantly a dissident Republican threat, which is targeting Catholics who join the organization. And there have been some tragic cases of Catholics killed and very, very seriously injured, as other members of the organization have been too. But anecdotally, it certainly looks like there is a targeting of Catholics in particular. There also appear to be ongoing legacy issues in terms of culture, and that may impact recruitment and particularly retention. People may join and think, actually, you know, maybe this isn't the kind of organization I thought it was. Maybe I don't want to be here. And that is really serious, really, really serious. So in order for, you know, change is a constant thing. You don't just get to the point where you've done the change and everything is fine, as we all know, in organizational terms. But, you know, there is probably still, I would say, a job of work in terms of cultural change, which has not yet been completed in the way some of the structural changes were. And we all know that cultural change is the hardest thing. And that's what we're beginning to see. And we've seen incidents over the past number of years, which would give rise to a concern around culture within the organization.
So Queen's University and any role that they play with PSNI in terms of helping to develop training or to accredit training for college credit, how does it work?
Well, the PSNI, you know, work with both universities in Northern Ireland, the University of Ulster, and ourselves in terms of recruitment and training. And the University of Ulster would have a role in terms of the training of student officers. We have recently won a tender to do some work with more senior officers, which is fantastic. One of the things I think that we really welcome is the fact that some of that work, which the PSNI may have gone outside Northern Ireland for previously, that sort of leadership development work, is now, you know, we're able to do that within Northern Ireland, and that's really important. So we're delighted in Queen's to be working closely with the PSNI, and we hope to continue to do that.
Let's talk about that. So yourself being a leadership guru and an organizational guru, that's my term. You didn't
yeah,
say that.
Thanks for that.
But I'd have to think and hope that you're a thinker, that you, whether you believe it or not, are a thought leader. And so you're leading discussions with people, whether that's in class or that is at the police academy. You have access or will have access to senior leaders. What are the conversations? What are the focus of conversations? How do you develop a leader? How do you change a mindset? What are the things you talk about in those rooms?
Well, you know, one of the things that it's really important to say here is that police leaders are extraordinarily capacitous in my experience. They are really, really good at what they do, and they really understand leadership. They really get it. So how much we can, as academics and practitioners, how much we can teach them, I don't really know, because my experience has been, and this has always been my experience, my academic experience of engaging police officers from many jurisdictions, is that they really think deeply about issues of leadership, very important to them. So whenever we engage with people, it's important that we have a role which challenges. So whether we challenge people in relation to their leadership and their own leadership development, or whether we challenge them in terms of organizational development in those processes, whether that's culture, whether that's resilience, you know, whether that's these types of organizational attributes that we know were incredibly significant, particularly at the moment in the kind of environment we're in relation to the pandemic, or whether we provide a sounding board for them to talk to us about the sort of challenges they have. So it's very much, or, you know, I certainly see these as co-produced outcomes. We say to people, well, the research would tend to say this, this, and this, and they talk us through the kind of challenges that they see in leadership terms. And for most police organizations, business or organizations. The challenges are very often about managing people. Challenges are very often about articulating their own leadership, about having confidence in their own decisions, about looking to see what's out there in terms of the work that they do, and us being able to give them access to some other thought leaders. So one of the things that we do, we're very focused on, is to put in place things like masterclass sessions with. We're extraordinarily fortunate in Queens in that we have a fantastic network of individuals from lots of other disciplines and from other sectors. We have some extraordinary honorary professors. We have people, professors of practice that we're connected to. And those people are able to give leaders from the police, but from other organizations as well, a really interesting perspective on leading in other contexts. And that, I think, I wouldn't like to think that we simply rely on ourselves and our academic expertise. We want to be able to connect police leaders to other people around the university and who are sitting between the university and wider society. And I think that's one of the things that we do best. And whether that's Brexit or whether that's resilience or whether that managing the wider environment, whether that giving people an insight into political change that's going on, political processes, having that network is critical.
So it would seem to me is while you're putting people in front of police leaders, you're posing questions, you're making them think, you're asking them to reflect, you're asking them to consider where they are now, where they could be in a safe environment. That's my best guess.
Yes, absolutely.
And, it strikes me it's that PSNI is a relatively new organization, that it's still going through some growing pains. And I understand that. We've seen transitions here in the United States. And I remember when the Mass State Police incorporated a number of other smaller organizations into the Mass State Police, it was always, well, you're one of them. You're not one of us. You didn't go to our academies, that kind of stuff that takes a little bit of time. Exactly what you said, takes a little bit of time for the culture to either change or for people to kind of move along. Here's what I'm hearing when we talk about leadership. And I'm going to ask you in terms of your perspective, what exactly are some of the important elements of leadership? What would you say?
I mean, that's a really interesting question because leadership is a huge area and leadership has changed enormously in terms of how we think about leadership over time. So people often talk about leadership traits, leadership qualities. I tend to think less about leadership qualities than about the ability to develop leadership practices over time in a way that is authentic. So we talk to people a great deal about adaptive leadership, about thinking about what their leadership means, how they can bring the best of themselves to their leadership practice, and how they can incorporate learning. You know, there's lots of different leadership ideas out there, and people talk endlessly about transformational leadership and transactional leadership and authentic leadership and servant leadership and all these other things. And so you can take your pick of whatever model works for you. And some models do genuinely speak to individuals more than others, and that's fine. The really important thing is to be able to reflect on your leadership, to understand that it's something which is always in development and that your leadership practice changes day to day. So what we try to do is to give people the best of what's out there and to say to them, you know, think about this. Think about what matters to you. Think about what matters to the people you're trying to lead. And then also think about leadership through the organization. Leadership doesn't reside in a leader. We all know within all the organizations we've been in that people very often at the bottom of the organization demonstrate just as much, sometimes more leadership than those at the top. And that's incredibly important. Now, what's at the top matters undoubtedly. It tends to, again, for any of us who are interested in organizations, it tends to cascade down. But, you know, we have to begin to see leadership as something which occurs at all levels and can occur at all levels. So when we talk about leadership and I talk about leadership, I tend to talk about that. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. One of the things that I think when we're talking is to try to help leaders, new leaders, current leaders, think a bit differently, think a bit more broadly, and look at leadership studies, leadership cases, leadership successes and failures, and try to adapt them. In other words, don't just look at police leadership.
Absolutely.
Look at business leadership, look at academic leadership, look at health leadership, those kinds of things. And how can we adapt those ideas and bring them into the culture of policing?
Yeah.
Is that something? It sounds to me like that's one of the things
that
you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I know you're an ex-cop, Dave, and, you know, don't take this the wrong way, but police, in my experience, people who sit within police organizations believe that police organizations are different. But you speak to people in health organizations, they think their organizations are different, or you speak to people in political organizations, you know. So it's very important to understand, I think, that leadership is leadership. We see good examples of leadership all over the place. The one thing that I do tend to say to people again and again and again is that leadership is about change. It's not about the status quo. It's about moving things forward and it's about driving change. Now, connected to that, of course, are things like visioning, things like like communication, things like authenticity. One of the things that we don't talk about enough, and it's a real shame, and I think we're causing us a lot of damage, is that we don't talk enough about forgiveness. Because leaders make mistakes. They make huge mistakes. They make mistakes all the time, and there's no leaders that don't. And yet we seem to expect people to be able to go through entire careers without doing anything wrong ever. And that forces leaders themselves into positions, into defensive positions, which are really unhelpful. So broader understanding of the reality of human experience and what leadership is within it is incredibly important. People often look at leadership figures, and the leadership figures that we look at are actually incredibly flawed, but we just happen to look at the bit where they were successful. Churchill is a case in point. You know, we forget about all of the real huge mistakes, political and military, that he made pre-World War II and after World War II, and we just look at the success. So I say, you know, I'm always saying to people, remember people make mistakes. Remember there has to be some room for forgiveness, and leaders have to be able to forgive as well, you know, because people at all levels in organizations will make errors. And yet that is something which is rarely talked about, but something you see in very skilled leaders. Very interesting. So change, communication, being able to articulate a vision, being able to talk to people in a way that they understand, being able to talk to them through different methods, because when you're leading change, people hear things in different ways. They absorb information in different ways, which is often forgotten as well. All incredibly important and not easy. You know, that's the other thing we forget about leadership. It's really, really, really hard, and it's draining for leaders. But
yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that, because as you're talking, and by the way, I'm not offended that I used to be a police officer. I've come a long way, and I think
I know.
I have come a long way, and I look at things much differently now as an academic, but I know and love the men and women in policing. And no matter where I go, there are similarities that are palpable. You can tell. But I'm listening to you about sort of the elements of leadership you speak about, and I think there has to be some empathy, and that goes to forgiving. Yeah. I like what you had to say there, because we should be able to learn from our mistakes.
Absolutely.
And take a look back. What can we do better? And I think engaging others, not making decisions unilaterally or in a vacuum, and listening is a very important skill, if you will, for leaders. And speak to that for a moment.
And that's really important. And that's something that we've seen critically over the past year or 18 months in relation to the pandemic. What we know is that leaders who lead well and successfully through crises have a tendency to bring people in, not shut them out. They tend to be more open to communication than less. They tend to actively look for a contrary argument. They tend to be better at sifting information and horizon scanning in terms of what's going on, because they have a better network, we tend sometimes to talk about a social network of leadership. And that's about leaders who connect with other leaders at all levels through the organization, not just peer to peer in terms of other CEOs or other chief constables or whatever we're thinking about. And that's really critical. Now, what we have seen over the past 18 months in lots of organizational environments is the idea that leaders can either be open and can be communicative, can be reflective and thoughtful, or can shut down. And the shutting down and the pulling up the drawbridge can be very dangerous in leadership terms, because that shows that people aren't listening anymore.
We need to wind down in a minute. Another thought you conjured in my mind was, no matter who you're leading or what organization or what discipline you're in, it's all about people, and it's about relating to people. It's about engaging people. It's about listening to people and helping, not getting more out of them, but helping them move forward.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I think is important. So here's a couple of curveball questions for you. What's on your to-do list?
Right now? Gosh.
Anytime.
Yeah.
What do you want to accomplish? What's on that to-do list that is going to be difficult, but you want to move forward?
Well, you know, I'm very fortunate. We spoke about this just before we started recording, that I'm just about to embark on a sabbatical, a period of research leave. During that period, I'll be doing another book. I've just done a book, but I'm embarking on another one. So I've just done one on management and war, management and conflict. But I'm looking at doing a piece of work on a part of the Irish government called the Department of Foreign Affairs and their relationship to the conflict in Northern Ireland, which I'm really looking forward to, which has been a real privilege to collect that data and to do that work. I'm still looking very closely at policing in Northern Ireland. You know, that's where I sort of started with this, and I'm still continuing to do that. So hopefully I'll actually be doing some work with some colleagues in America around that and around policing and Brexit. Brexit's been a big issue for us here in terms of the UK leaving the European Union and its impact on the position of Northern Ireland. And that's something which isn't looking good at the minute. So we'll be doing some more work on that. And then I think just thinking, you know, it's lovely to have a little bit of time to do some of this thinking around leadership and change, because, you know, we're in a world which seems to be getting more volatile rather than less. We started off talking about the events in the US Capitol, and I think that's indicative of some of the concerns that we all have for the volatility that surrounds us at the minute. And having spending a little bit of time just think about the place of leadership within that is very important. It was interesting. I was reading a piece of work on leadership during the Bosnian War a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't, I read it before, but I hadn't read it in a long time. And I read it again. It was an article by an ex-soldier who had become an academic, a wee bit like yourself, except from the military end rather than the policing end. And in the middle of the article, there was a little vignette about Joe Biden, which is very interesting, and talked about Biden in Bosnia, because Biden at that point was on the Foreign Affairs Committee, had gone to Bosnia and was speaking to some soldiers in Bosnia, and they were talking about the difficulties they were having in relation to the genocidal conditions at the time. And the soldier said to Biden, well, you know, we just basically we can't walk away. We have to intervene. We can't walk away. And Biden's response was a very generous, very kind response. It was something like, you've been here too long, son. And now that was 20 years ago. And yet it was very similar to the sort of stuff we're hearing in the American media now from Joe Biden. So there's something there about a consistency too and an authenticity, which I thought was really interesting. And it made me reflect about leadership in dangerous times. And I think we are living through dangerous times at the moment. So all of those thinking, all of those thoughts, I think, are on my to-do list.
That's a big to-do list. I was going to ask you about what books you read, but where do you find yourself looking for information to expand your thoughts, to conjure new ideas and to do the thinking you talk about leadership as it applies to many different segments?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, academics are incredibly privileged. Read things and think about things and delve into areas of knowledge that allow us a latitude that very few people have. And so I try, and I've always tried, to think a bit more deeply, because particularly about things like leadership and change, because I think they're huge. You know, they're things that go to the very heart of human existence and human society. At the minute, I'm reading a book by the psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust survivor and who wrote brilliantly about the human experience and how we deal with the demons of the past and how we move to the future, because dealing with the legacy of conflict and past violence is a big theme in my work. And I'm a big fan of Frankl in terms of his work and what he was able to do and how he was able to think through the legacy of dreadful experiences. I'm also reading, or I'm going back to read again, a book by a Bosnian academic called Haris Halovic. It's called Places of Pain, which is about the genocide in Bosnia. Haris himself is a survivor of genocide in Srebrenica, and it's an extraordinary work. Haris is an anthropologist, and I think one of the things that's brilliant about management studies is that you're able to delve into other areas of arts and social science, and to be able to learn from our colleagues who are sociologists and anthropologists and economists is incredibly significant. So those are the kind of things that I'm reading at the minute. But I also, I have to, on a sort of lighter note, I have to tell you that I'm also reading, or I've just finished, a book, J.K. Rowling's latest detective novel, which has a criminal focus, which is an excellent book if you're looking for something slightly lighter. But you know, that kind of engagement with policing and that kind of world, I think is endlessly fascinating for those of us who are fortunate enough to study it, but who are a little bit apart from it as well. So that's kind of what I'm doing at the minute.
So here's my last question. If you had a chance to talk with anybody dead or alive who is renowned in some way, who would that be?
Goodness me, you should have warned me in advance. Goodness me, that is an extraordinary question. Oh, this is terrible. And I'm just saying this, but I'll probably get criticized for saying this. Probably Bobby Kennedy. And
why would you be? Why would you be criticized?
People go, oh, well, you know, Irish America, Bobby Kennedy. But probably Bobby Kennedy, because I think, you know, I write about leadership, but I teach leadership too. And Bobby Kennedy's speech in Minneapolis on the day of Martin Luther King's murder is an extraordinary speech. And when I talk to students about leadership, I get them to listen to that speech. It's only 7 or 8 minutes. I'm sure you know it, Steve. And it's an extraordinary piece of work, you know. And I think the speech relates to America, but I think in relation to any environment which has suffered violence and conflict, it really speaks to the heart of what people think. Bobby Kennedy's death, any death is a tragedy, but there is something particularly poignant about the death of Bobby Kennedy after his own journey. And I think that speech in particular is the speech I tend to think about when it comes to leadership. So I suppose I'd have to choose Bobby Kennedy.
Nothing wrong with that choice. That's a great choice. Well, we're going to wind up with Dr. Joanne Murphy, who is talking to us from Belfast, Northern Ireland. She is a member of the faculty at Queen's University and works in leadership and has worked with police service in Northern Ireland for many years. I want to thank you for joining us.
And
I love the fact that technology, while it is a little warbly here and there, is allowing us to from one side of the pond to the other. I appreciate that. Thank
Brilliant.
You.
Lovely to speak to you, Stephen. Hopefully we'll get to see you in the flesh and we'll give you a good Irish welcome.
Let COVID be damned. And so you've been listening to Steve Morielli in Boston, Joanne Murphy in Belfast, Northern Ireland. This is the Cop Doc Podcast. We appreciate you listening and would ask you to continue listening to other episodes. Thanks and have a good day. Before you go, if you'd like to reach out, comment, provide feedback, or have a topic that could be considered to explore in the future, contact me via LinkedIn, Facebook, or send me an email at copdoc.podcast@gmail.com. That's copdoc.podcast@gmail.com. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes where we'll be talking with a distinguished professor from Virginia Commonwealth University, the former commissioner of the Boston Police Department, and the academic director of the Baltimore Police Academy, to name just a few. I'm very happy now that the Cop Doc Podcast is listed on Law Enforcement Today's podcast network. Among other police-related podcasts I'd recommend, when you have time, I suggest you take time to listen to Law Enforcement Today Radio with Jay Wiley. You might also listen to Pat Fitzgibbons on his podcast, The CJ Evolution, or Policing Matters from Police One with Jim Dudley. You can find links to these recommended police-related podcasts on our website at www.copdocpodcast.com. Intermittently, you'll hear from me in micro-podcasts called Reflections and Ruminations on Leadership. These short pieces will raise leadership and organizational issues and discuss problems and practices, as well as the elements of leadership for you to consider. I look forward to continuing to talk with colleagues in the field of policing, criminal justice think tanks, community, academics, and researchers. And for those of you still in the trenches, I wish you my best and implore you to stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you for what you do to keep our community safe. This is Steve Morielli in Boston. Thanks so much for listening to the Cop Doc Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Cop Doc Podcast with Dr. Steve Morielli. Steve is a retired law enforcement practitioner and manager turned academic and scholar from Worcester State University. Please tune into the Cop Doc Podcast for regular episodes of interviews with thought leaders in policing.